Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Once again, I wanted to, first and foremost, thank Jimmy Spatz for hosting us here today in this beautifully, very rarely warm day here in November. It's so warm, it's actually raining. And I understand that we're in for more rain, which means more warm weather. Too bad it's not sunny. Anyway, I was asked by Jimmy. I gave him a few topics, and he decided to pick this one. And though I sent him the heading, I had no idea what it's about, because I just thought the heading's nice. Men in Black, the meaning behind Jewish clothing. How many? Everyone here saw the movie Men in Black?
Yeah.
Anyone here didn't see the movie? Wonderful. Oh, I'm sorry. This movie is about like a secret force in New York City that fights aliens that no one knows about. But one of the things that they did was they all wore black suits and black ties and black sunglasses, and everybody was dressed alike. So when you walked around the street and you had a bunch of them, obviously they stood out because they all dress alike. You all know, and that's exactly it, Mark. Explain. Hasidim all wear the same clothing. And as a matter of fact, if I really wanted to be a good teacher, I'd set up a nice projector here. I download pictures from the internet, and I can show you the differences between Hasidic groups based on dress. So you can take a typical street in Jerusalem.
I saw that show, Kotel, a week Friday.
That's right, we were there.
What show?
The different Hasidim. So you arrived there a little bit early, a little bit before Shabbat.
Oh, you think so, actually.
I didn't even know there's a presentation at the Kotel.
So our guide, Ezra, your guide, was there, and he just started to tell me how you can tell different people.
The big cats, the small fur.
The fur, and where it is. Socks.
White socks, black socks. That's right.
Lots of.
So as you could see, in the Jewish world today, you have various groups that all dress alike. And the question that we're going to deal with is, A, is there any validity to it? B, what's the logic behind it? And C, are we now sitting here today, and I'm looking around the room and everybody is dressed differently, are we an apologetic Jewish community that's not doing it? Meaning it's all right, but we really should? Or no, we're actually doing what we should be doing, and those groups are unique. And finally, we're going to deal with, if those groups are unique, then what indeed are the restrictions or obligations of Jewish clothing? So let's begin right at the beginning. And that is a very, very important point that I said earlier. When you walk around the street and you're wearing a fur hat, especially if you're in Jerusalem and the weather happens to be hot in the middle of the summer, and you're wearing a fur hat, then obviously what do you look like? Let's just say it nicely. You stand out, right? So if you stand out, why are you doing it? And the question is being Jewish, or being different to be more precise, a Jewish ideal? Or maybe we should blend in with society. And I'm going to give you an example. We're going to go through a few sources. And I want to give you an example. Excuse me for picking on you, Victor, but you got it. What are you wearing on your lapel?
A poppy.
A poppy. Can Jews wear a poppy? Now, why do people wear poppies at this time of the year, right before Veterans Day?
To remember, to signify.
Why the poppy? A beautiful poem by a guy from Afghanistan. Does anybody in that poem, does that poem have any sort of connotation to idol worship? Was it written by idol worshippers? No. So let's see what the Torah says about poppies. Let's start with the written Torah. Vayikra, chapter 18, verses 1 through 3, and the Lord had spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. Like the practice of the land of Egypt, in which you dwelled, you shall not do, and like the practice of the land of Canaan, to which I am bringing you, you shall not do, and you shall not follow in their statutes. So, from that verse, does that mean that we can't wear poppies? Take a look at the verse and tell me if you think that verse says you can't wear poppies. There's two options to understand that verse. First of all, it could be a general verse saying you cannot follow the practices of the non-Jews, with Egypt and Canaan being mere examples. Or maybe not. Maybe it's a local prohibition specifically targeted to two places, two kinds of people, Egyptians and Canaanites, none of which exist today. So Egyptians and Canaanites, because of their terrible ways, you can't follow in anything they do. But any other non-Jewish custom, you can follow. Two options, correct? Which one do you think is more logical, reading the verse?
The specific one.
The specific one. I think you're right. I happen to agree. I can see it the other way, but it seems much more specific. Now, let's look at another verse, just two chapters later, same book, third book of the Bible, Vayikra, chapter 20, verses 23 through 24. You shall not follow the practices... You shall not follow just the practices of the nation that I am sending away from before you. For they committed all these sins, and I was disgusted with them. I am the Lord your God, who has distinguished you from the peoples. The first part of the first clause of the pasuk, I would say, goes according to Victor's interpretation, specific. Not following the practices of the nations that live in Israel prior to your arrival. Anyone know what those nations are called? Not the Goyim, no.
Canaanites,
Girgashites, Amorites, all these nations that lived in Israel prior to the Jewish arrival there by Joshua.
The Aboriginal.
They're known by the acronym the Seven Canaanite Nations. Those nations you cannot follow, don't do anything they did. But the last clause is already not so specific. It's rather, I would say, a little more general, don't you think? I am the Lord your God who has distinguished you from the peoples. Which seems to connote that there's a Jewish ideal to be distinguished from the peoples. Now, with that, a total different, that a reading that we can't put in, let's see what the Rambam says. The Rambam, who the hospital in Haifa is named after, amongst many, many different institutions in the world. Rabbi Dr. Maimonides. Moshe ben Maimon functioned, anybody know when? I always forget. 13th century, right?
Yeah.
Around 13th century, okay? I see here, Rabbi Feldman brought along exactly what I printed, the one you're going to quote. Hilarious. So this is one of the books, of the 14 books of the Maimonides, Code of Jewish Law, known as his Mishneh Torah, right? Magnum opus of the Maimonides, amongst his many writings, which is both philosophy writing, medical writings, and whatnot. He writes the laws of idol worship. Can anyone explain to me what that might be? Is that telling you how to be an idol worshiper? Obviously not. What you can't do in the realm of idol worship, right. Chapter 11, subdivision 1. We are forbidden following the ways of idol worshippers, or nations of the world, and we are not to look like them, neither in our clothing, nor in our hair, etc. As it states, and in their laws you shall not walk, and more. Meaning the Maimonides quotes various different verses in the Torah that says you shall not work in the name of idol worshippers. And that's a very big question. You see, when rabbis put out various writings, sometimes because they were scared for their life, they did something that you shouldn't do, but was done. It starts with a C. Censor. There were censored versions of the Rambam. And it could very well be, and according to many different documents that they found later on, that the word here of Dei Kochavim in Hebrew, which means idol worshippers, was originally non-Jews. But because he was living in a non-Jewish society, and he was scared to write that in, he put in a different word. But he really means all non-Jews, not just specifically idol worshippers. Namely, not just people that bow down to the chair and say that it's God, but all non-Jews. You have to look different from them in your hair, in your clothing, etc., etc. All can only that we shall not look like them, but rather be separated from them, and it will be seen and noticeable in your dress and other actions. Rather, you shall wear special clothing and not grow your hair like them and ensure to leave sideburns, etc. Meaning the Jew is not just enough for him to be different, he has to look different. And we say that every Saturday night in Havdalah. How do we end the Havdalah? Look at the bottom of the page. Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol, God, you made a distinction between holy and non-holy. Ben Or l'chol shech, the same distinction that you made between light and darkness, ben Yisrael la'amin, between Israel, the nations of the world. We're distinct, we're different. Ben Yom HaShvi'i l'Sheshet Yimei HaMaaseh, between the seventh day of Shabbat and the rest of the days of the week. There's a difference between Saturday versus Sunday through Friday. There's a difference between light and darkness, and there's a difference between us and the nations of the world. And as you see from the Rambam, it's not enough to be different maybe in your own home, but rather you must show that you're different. And the question we're going to deal with right now is understanding that there is an ideal to be different. How different? And I refer you back to the poppy question. Because that poppy question is not only germane at this time of the year, it's a beautiful example of a custom that's not an idol worship custom, not a pagan custom, that was initiated by non-Jews. I would say no one in this room has any issue with it. It's a beautiful custom. Are we allowed to do it?
Well, we should be, if we're not, because Jews were also killed.
No, no, for Jews. No,
the question is not so much.
Yeah, but it's not just for. It's not just for. It's for all of those who fought.
Correct. So that's exactly the question. You have a custom. It's a beautiful one.
You'd like to take part in the very last.
You want to be part of honoring the veterans, not just by remembering them, but by showing it on your lapel.
I haven't seen many Hasidim with poppies in my shop. I
haven't seen many Hasidim in Halifax either. But that's not anyway.
They weren't poppies anywhere else in Canada.
Let's see.
Everywhere.
Yeah, poppies is everywhere. I saw Parliament last night. By the way, I never understood this. Everyone in the street in Halifax are so polite, so nice. I'm assuming all Canadians are in some way or another polite and nice. You get to Parliament. Oh, my gosh. It's like the Israeli Knesset.
Yeah.
That's all we do in Halifax.
A guy gets up and talks. Shut up! Yeah, yeah, no, you're talking.
I'm going to maybe a stupid question. So this Rambam laws, this is his interpretation of the law.
This
and
is
all
the
of a sudden
yeah.
It's become the law.
This is the Rambam. What happened was is like this. I'll give a 30-second answer on it because it needs a little bit of a background. The oral Torah was ultimately written down. Because people began to forget. Meaning what God gave to Moses at Sinai was ultimately written down the Mishnah and the Gemara. And the problem is it's all live debate. It's hard to find codes there. So Jews ought to know what to do. They don't want to know all the philosophy behind it. So different people wrote codes based on the Talmud. One of them was the Rambam. So he read the Talmud, read the various sources, and wrote down very explicitly what we're supposed to do and what we're not supposed to do. So that's the code that the Rambam wrote.
He was the people that had the authority to
but
codify
so
the law.
So does it say in the actual sources that you're supposed to leave sideburns?
Yeah.
Interpretation.
Sideburns are written down in the Torah itself, in the biblical Torah, actually. We read about it in Parshat Kedoshim, which is in the book of Vayikra as well. I didn't quote it here, but it's there. Other sources, obviously, in the oral Torah, they're not written in the biblical Torah, but the sideburns actually is written in. Interesting. That's, by the way, very important when you go to your barber. First time you have a new barber, you have to teach him a few laws. It's a beautiful experience. You give him a Torah, you give him a lunch and learn. Yeah.
The other side always is the counterbalance of having to live within the laws of the kingdom in which you're living. How do you balance that out?
The question of balancing out the laws of the Torah with the laws of the land, if there's a confrontation, is a large question that we once dealt with in a lunch and learn many a time ago. I can't remember when.
Yeah.
But that's a very, very good question that connects to this. Here we're saying there's no confrontation. There's a law, there's a custom. People are doing it. They're wearing poppies. So the question is, are we allowed to adopt it? Because after all, there is an ideal to be different. So what does it mean to be different? So let's see about the poppies. Go to page 2. Right in the back of page 1. I'm sorry there's no page numbers there. We have a fascinating difference of opinion. I'm not going to read it all between Tosfot and the Ran. Tosfot was the collection of writings of various rabbis that functioned in Germany, some of them in France, that were all grandsons of the famous Rashi. Now, Tosfot takes a very radical point of view and says any custom of non-Jews, whether pagan in originality or non-pagan in originality, a Jew is not allowed to do. He has to be different, look different, see different, and as a matter of fact, if he's not different, he's doing something wrong.
When you say pagan, you mean idol worshippers, that sort of thing, but you don't mean Christians or Western.
Good question. With Christians, it's a very interesting dichotomy. For a non-Jew, as you know, they have to keep how many commandments? Anybody know?
No.
A non-Jew has to keep seven Noach commandments, they're called. Seven Noachite commandments. One of them is idol worship. They're not allowed to do idol worship. However, that definition of idol worship for a non-Jew is different than the definition for a Jew. We're also not allowed to do idol worship as part of the 613, but it's a different definition. For a non-Jew, idol worship means bowing down to the chair and saying that it's God. But the Trinity, am I pronouncing it right?
Trinity.
The Trinity, namely believing that God has helpers, there is one God, but he has helpers. That is not idol worship, according to most authorities, like the Meiri and others, for a non-Jew. For a Jew, however, the definition of idol worship is a little more severe, and therefore it is idol worship for a Jew. So if there is a Christian custom, a Jew is not allowed to adopt it, according to full authorities as we're about
to
see.
It's not viewed as pagan.
What? It is viewed as a custom that is semi-pagan.
But not pagan, because you were...
Right, so I'm going to try to I'm going to try to clarify by saying any custom of another religion that a Jew is not allowed to engage in because of this problem of idol worship. So therefore, that basically means not only is Halloween and Christmas out, but according to the Tosfot, it has to be your life's job to look outside the street, see what the common custom is, and do the opposite. So I'll give you the simple example. The poppies definitely know. And let's say, what's the custom today? Three button suits or two button suits? Whatever the local style is, you must go against it. That's the Tosfot radical opinion. It's right there on the top of the page.
If black became a popular way to look, you'd have to start dressing differently.
You're right. If everybody wore black, these people would probably have to follow the Tosfot and have to start wearing gray. Yeah. You're right.
Then they have to be worried about wearing fur hats in 40 degrees Celsius weather.
No, there must be an exception.
The Hasidim, for sure, accepted this point of view in a way, but they had another reason for it, and I'll say it later. It could very well be that the reason why Hasidim dress the way they do is to look different than the common fashion. Not just the fashion that's an idol worship fashion, but any fashion. I'm wearing a suit that I bought in the local store. A chassid cannot do that. They have to go to a special store that has to be called unfashionable clothing for Jews that follow the Tosfot.
Oh, that's for the Tosfot.
Wait, I'm not finished. Yeah, the Tosfot, he's radical. I want to make sure that everyone's calm because the Tosfot was not accepted according to the Code of Jewish Law and the overwhelming majority of Jewish authorities. Rather, the exception was the Ran. The Ran functioned around the same time as Tosfot, not so much in the Ashkenazic countries, rather in the Sephardic countries, known as Rabbeinu Nisim. He's very known because the Tosfot is printed on the page of the Talmud as an interpretation, and the Ran is printed in the back of the Talmud, most Talmudic volumes. And the Ran writes, the Torah only forbade pagan customs, namely customs that are part of a religious practice, even if they are not so today. Namely, a custom that began as a pagan custom but was commercialized. Christmas. The way they celebrate Christmas today is not the way Jesus' followers celebrated Christmas. However, things that make sense are totally allowed. Namely, you have a custom. It makes sense. It's not an idol worship custom. You can do it. You got your poppy. Ron says poppy's great. Give you another example. A white coat for a doctor. Dr. Ross, where did the white coat come from? Good question. We don't, as far as we know, there's no evidence that it came from a pagan custom or a non-Jewish custom that was embedded in idol worship. Doctors can wear white coats to show that they're doctors, not patients, when they walk around an office. The poppy I mentioned, stylish suits. You can go on and on. As long as it's not a custom of another religion. And as you could see, the Code of Jewish Law, once you're a day or 178, subdivision 1, accepted this point of view. And even brings the example, of all things, of the white coat, which means when there are moth function in Krakow in the 16th century, I believe, 15th to 16th century, I forgot, doctors were already wearing white coats. And he said, it's totally and utterly permissible. Yeah?
There must be an exception for when you're a target.
Why? Well, life, look, you're making an exception when you're a target and you look different.
So, of course, a target,
you know,
not just as a bully, right? But maybe for anti-Semites.
You're right.
You and knock your hat off, or tear your beard off, or make you a target, as happening now in Paris, with or in parts of France.
You're asking a very good question, because ultimately I'd say to you that life always overrides religion, right?
Yeah.
But this might be different, because life overrides religion except for three cardinal commandments, right? That's only in a case where they're not fighting against Judaism, they're fighting against a specific Jew because they don't like him. Nothing gets in religion, I don't like you. Not because you're Jewish, but because I don't like you. I have this hatred for the Jewish people, fine. But if they're fighting against the Jewish religion, namely they want to go ahead and say, we don't want Jews to wear kippot anymore, anywhere, then you have to fight on every mitzvah. It's called in Hebrew, Sha'at Hashmad. So what's happening in Paris, it's hard to judge it. My tendency is to believe, as the rabbis in Paris have defined it, that it's a regular situation where they don't like the Jews, so definitely don't be a target. Life is more important than religion, and that's what most rabbis in Paris are saying. I mean, I'm not in Paris, I'm not there, and I can't see it for myself, but emails come back and forth, whatever. And that seems to be it. question is it a fight against the religion of Judaism? That's a question. If it is, it's a different situation, but I don't think that's a situation today.
So suppose the compromise is to keep the kippa on and put the baseball cap on, which makes you look like all of the others, so you're not differentiating yourself.
No question. I'm going to try to give you a better example to maybe clarify it, and that is a very common practice in New York and other places, thank God not in Israel, but once upon a time in Israel, you'd be surprised in the 50s, the way you keep at work. Many, many good Jews, Shomer Shabbos Jews, take off the kippah at work. Now, is that allowed? Now, kippah is not even a law. What is it? It's not a rabbinic law, it's not a biblical law, so what is it?
Custom.
Now, it's a custom, it's not such a law, but even so, it's a very widely accepted custom. The question is why they're taking off their kippah. They're taking off their kippah because they don't want to bring religion into the workplace. And that's fine. Nobody brings religion into the workplace. You don't wear a kippah, you don't wear a cross, etc., etc. The Arab doesn't wear his keffiyeh. Fine. But if the reason why you don't wear the kippah is because you don't want to be identified as a Jew because clients hate the Jewish religion, it's a bigger question. It's a bigger question. My father, when he was living in America before we made Aliyah in 1988, you could say one of the reasons we made Aliyah is he didn't have to do this anymore, he took off his kippah at work. And no one had a problem with him being Jewish. After all, he took off all the holidays of the year, he took off every Shabbos of the year, and obviously everybody knew he was an Orthodox Jew. But they don't want to bring religion into the workplace. That's fine. That's fine. Well, question is what's happening in Paris today, and that's a good question.
I'm going to ask you afterwards about the debate around Muslim women.
Good question. Muslim women today.
Speak, but don't interrupt.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, accordingly, the poppy is totally okay according to the overwhelming majority of authorities. Stylish suits are okay. And as you could see, maybe the Hasidim took a different point of view, taking the Tosfot, minority opinion, but still a legitimate opinion. I just want to add one more thing before we go on, because we have one question we still have to deal with, and that is, well, if we're not different in our clothing, then in what way are we different? We saw on the first page it's an ideal to be different. Not in clothing, so in what way? But before I do that, I just want to clarify with Hasidim, I think there's another reason why they wear the same clothing. Wearing different clothing, I can understand. Tosfot opinion, but why do they all wear the same?
As each other.
In other words, instead of just the chassid going into the unfashionable store,
right,
he has to go in an unfashionable store for
Satmar,
that Hasidic group, for Satmar. And if he's a Gerer Hasid, he has to go into the store for the Gerer Hasidim. And if he's a Bubbaver Hasid, etc., etc. And the answer, I think, is very simple. And we have a Hasid next to me, he can correct me. Everybody here is familiar with the term fraternity? When you are part of a fraternity, you want to show it. So if you're part of a larger group than yourself,
sure,
it gives you that self-determination.
Yeah.
I finally understood this the first time I left my base when I was a soldier and went home for Shabbos. Mm-hmm. You came to the central bus station and people were trying to sell things to you. You know the way it is in Israel. Sometimes an open market, everyone's screaming and yelling on the top of their lungs. Mm-hmm. So how did they call out my name? Did they say Yehoshua? They say you with the kippah on your head. What did they say?
Bro.
Soldier! Bro. Soldier! Soldier. Now, there's 20,000 soldiers in here. Chayav, boina. Why? You're part of a fraternity now called the army. You all wear the same uniform. You're not alone. You're part of an army. So it definitely gives a chassid that self-confidence when he's part of a larger group and he's connected to a specific rebbe. And that's what I think is another reason why they all wear the same clothes within the same group.
I just want to make a little correction. I'm not sure about what you mean by self-confidence or anything. It's certainly a fraternity, certainly a group. It's a uniform. You belong to a certain...
What I try to say is that basically Rabbi Feldman's living in Halifax, but he's part of a larger Chabad movement worldwide.
Absolutely.
He doesn't think he's living here as a resident
Absolutely.
Of Halifax only, who's a Jew. And
absolutely.
And that's... You're wearing your clothing gives you that.
You belong
yes.
to a certain group. It's a uniform.
I thought it was a team player. There's a cyclone. Oh, are you talking to
yes, Victor, go.
It was a throwback to Poland or somewhere, whatever they used to wear at a certain point in time. Is there modesty an element, too, in the color and the type of clothing?
I once asked the chassid, why black? Answer he gave is because we're still in exile. The temple's not rebuilt, so we want to wear black.
I think that interpretation came after it was black. That wasn't the reason. It's more...
I'm not a big expert on how the dress began.
You know?
I think I understand it.
But sometimes the hats are in black.
Most cases of the half are usually black.
The fur is not always black, you're right. The fur sometimes is brown.
Brown, yeah. It's a brown fur around the
brown,
yeah.
Actually,
there's one fellow when we were
they were black with brown fur.
Almost everybody had a black hat.
Yeah.
One fellow had a beigey brown
hat. I've seen
that.
Yeah,
I know.
Now, what happened today is fascinating.
I have my uncle. Interesting, I have an uncle. I was a cousin. Okay, that's a little different. Shabbos, he wears a black hat, but during the week, he wears a gray suit and a gray hat.
One second.
And one other thing.
I want to add something, is that today, even non-Hasidim are wearing the same clothing. They've adopted the Hasidic practice.
It's mostly a hat. It's not,
and that is, they wear a black suit, short suit, black suit, black pants, white shirt only, and a black hat.
Yeah.
So even if you're non-Chassid, but you're part of what we call the ultra-Orthodox world, very big quotations put on the other side of that.
Yeah.
I don't like the term, but that's the popular term. Mm-hmm. They also started adopting it. I don't think it's for the better, but anyway.
Interesting psychologically, there's interesting things. Maybe the reason for the law was to stop assimilation.
Absolutely.
Could be.
However, the human being is so inclined psychologically to conform, to the conform within our own groups.
Hasidim
has kept the conformity
to
a team. We want
that's what I meant about that's what I meant about
conformity. We want to be on a team
exactly.
With a uniform. Some are knitted peepers, as you know.
Yeah.
Some are different dressed totally.
Okay,
short.
You should know once. I once had,
just a human
I had a,
being must conform.
You ever been in an Israeli bus?
So
I wanted to say
is,
a nice,
yeah.
You're right. You're right, by the way.
Mm.
You're absolutely right.
What's your point is that it does prevent assimilation to a certain degree.
Right.
Yes.
Assimilate our own groups then.
Because it's a large group. It's not just you alone. You're part of a larger group, and you're all dressing alike. And yes. And by the way, on that very point, I once had a chassid on the bus. You know, Israel buses, everybody talks to each other in debates.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting next to a chassid, and I was basically saying, I understand your point of view with the same clothing, but, you know, give a little, you know, credit. People won't assimilate so easily, whatever. So he says, what do you mean? You're the same way? I go, well, you all wear knitted kippahs.
Yeah.
I said, you're right, but there's a difference. What's the difference? No knitted kippahs alike. Every knitted kippah looks different.
But
no, he had a point. He threw a good one at me.
Well, what's the reason for the non-Jews and the Amish that wear the same types of clothes?
Good question. I don't know the Amish.
That
same
idea.
They don't
want
to assimilate.
Same fraternity.
Yeah.
Fraternity.
Now, I just want to say this one. I can interrupt for one second. You mentioned the Amish.
Yeah.
Once a fellow dressed with the garb, with the full nine yards, the hat, and the full clothing, he's sitting on the bus or on the plane next to... And this other Jewish lady walks in, or man, that's attacking him. You're bringing back old memories in the old country, and such a, we're in the 21st century, and come on, get with the program. It's such an embarrassment to the Jewish people, and she's going on and on and on. And, yeah, and he says, excuse me, ma'am, but I'm Amish. And, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it.
You're
not related.
Amish. They're not Amish.
That's not the end of the story. No,
yeah.
The end of the story is the fellow says, excuse me, I know you're yelling at me in some foreign German language with Yiddish. I understand you don't like my dress. I want you to know I'm Amish. Or oh, I'm so sorry. Look, I respect your people.
Yeah.
The way you would...
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
By the claim, it's okay.
Yeah. Look,
okay,
last week I was in Boston at a convention, and Nat Lewin, the famous lawyer, gave a beautiful keynote address in which he said, that his biggest fear coming before the Supreme Court in the United States is to get a Jewish judge. If it's a non-Jewish judge, it's a fair game. If it's a Jewish judge, it's biased against him representing the Jews. And that's the way it was in every case he did, from trying to defend Eruvs and others. And there's no question that you brought up a very good point. It's a sore point, and it's a terrible thing, but you're right. Anyway, we've established that you don't have to be different in the sense that you can't accept the poppy custom, you can't accept a white coat for a doctor, according to the overwhelming majority of authorities. So in what way are we different? When we say Avdolah, that God made a distinction, in what way? The simple solution is very simple. We have to keep 613 commandments. Non-Jews have to keep 7. So how are we different? In our conduct, in our lifestyle. We don't have to look differently. We are different in other ways. We have a Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. We have kosher food. We have other restrictions and obligations. We have other rights and I would also say other obligations in life. And therefore, we're different in that way. But we can't overlook men in black. Because even if you don't wear black clothing, and I don't, and I have to admit, even when I go to an ultra-Orthodox conference, I must be proud of who I am. And I always make sure to wear the knitted kippah. And I wasn't this courageous to wear a blue shirt, but I was courageous enough to wear a pink tie. But, let's face it, there is obligations in the realm of clothing in Judaism. You can't overlook it. And on this I want to say, and I'm going to quote my Rebbe, Rabbi Riskin, on this, externals sometimes influence the internals. And we're going to see that in a moment. Let's start with the first obligation. You can see the bottom of the page. We say it in the daily Shema, the obligation of tzitzit. If you wear a four-cornered garment, you have to wear tzitzit. If you don't wear a four-cornered garment, and no one here is wearing four-cornered garments, you don't have to wear tzitzit. However, the common custom today is that the Jews obligate themselves in this mitzvah, some only in the realm of the synagogue, but when they come to synagogue, they dafka put on a four-cornered garment known as a talis, and some every day by wearing a four-cornered garment under or above their clothing. You mentioned the Hasidim, they wear it above their clothing, which is probably the original way of doing it, and others, like me, wear it under their clothing. Some wear it, take their tzitzis out, like I do, and put it around their belt. Others take it out and let it dangle down, and some leave it inside. But tzitzit is definitely an obligation in the realm of clothing.
Obligation of men only? I don't see women in that.
Good question. Usually we assume that any mitzvah in the Torah, men and women are obligated equally. The reason why women are exempt, as I said, an exemption, it doesn't mean they can't do it, is because it's a time-bounded commandment in the sense that they're not obligated to wear tzitzit at night. You're only obligated to wear it during the day or the light hours. And therefore, since it's time-bounded, women are exempt like many other time-bounded commandments. Anyway, you want to hear a better reason, I'll tell you a better reason. What's the reason for the mitzvah of tzitzit, looking on the bottom of the page? Take a look. Tell me what you think.
Remember the commandments of the Lord.
So when you look at the tzitzit, you're supposed to remember all the commandments. It's supposed to be some sort of a barrier between you breaking the commandments and you keeping the commandments. It's by looking at those tzitzit, and that's probably why Jews have obligated themselves to wear it full time, it's a barrier between you and breaking the commandments. And it could very well be, and this is what I've said endless times in my synagogue, and I stand by it, I don't believe men and women are equal. I believe women are on a much superior level than men in Judaism. And in the realm of Judaism, they are much more holy. And maybe they don't need this barrier. They can do without it, and they still have the same result. Anyway, tzitzit is definitely an obligation of the clothing. Turning the page, you can see there's another obligation of the clothing called, less known, shatnez. What's shatnez? Wool or flax. Very rare today. However, in some suits, they do have this problem. And therefore, you've seen suits where if you think there is a problem, in the inside the suit is a little thing. In New York, you can send it to a lab. Sometimes the lab is in the department store already. And it says in there, checked for shatnez. And it's sewed up.
Is it flax or dissimilar? It's only flax or dissimilar.
Wool and flax.
It's specified as flax. Okay.
Yes.
Because if it was dissimilar, it would be a big problem.
Right. Yes, okay. Now, you should know that woolen, this particular mitzvah that I dealt with in my shul in the past, if you want to hear a lecture on it, you can go onto the website of the Beth Israel Synagogue and you can hear the lecture from 2 years ago on it, is a very fascinating one because wool is okay alone, and flax is okay alone, and only when they're sewn together is it no good. Does that remind you of any other prohibition?
Milk.
Excellent example. Milk is okay, meat is okay, when you put them together, it's the most vicious thing to do. And therefore, it's a very fascinating one, and hard to understand this mitzvah. It's only written one place in the Torah. We know for a fact that it's another obligation of the clothing. So there is obligations in the realm of clothing. Number three, how do you dress for davening? We won't go into this whole story, but it's a very simple one. Trachtei Shabbos, look and tell me.
You gave speeches on that.
Oh, endless, yeah. What's the bottom line? How do you dress for services?
In Canada, you dress as if you were meeting the Prime Minister, and in Israel, as if you're meeting the Prime Minister, so you dress differently.
Correct. It's subjective to where you live. Whatever way you would greet the local leader is the way you're supposed to dress for the leader of the world. That's the law. It changes from place to place, from time to time. As you could see in Trachtei Shabbat, they did very crazy things, in my opinion, like putting on stockings and praying, removing your cloak versus putting on your jacket, based on the customs and their times of greeting the king. Today, if I would write this Gemara, I'd write the same thing, prepare to meet the king, and I'd say, I don't know, suit and tie. In Israel, on a kibbutz, non-torn shorts with a t-shirt without writing on it. You can go on and on. In China, you know how they dress. So, therefore, you see again that God did command us to dress in a certain way. And finally, example number 4 and 5 and 6 are all in the realm of how to dress when. What's the common denominator 4, 5, and 6?
Special days.
Special days. You have to have special clothing for Shabbat. According to the code of Jewish law, you're supposed to have better clothing on Yontif than Shabbat. I try to fulfill this particular law by making sure that I only wear cufflinks on Yontif, not on Shabbos, and I have a special suit for Yontif as well, and special ties for Yontif, special ties for Shabbos, and special shirts for Shabbos as well. And Chol HaMoed, which the intermediate days of the holiday, as you could see from Tractate Sanhedrin 99a, there's a very famous line there that one who disgraces the holidays, and Rashi explains that means Chol HaMoed, has no share in the world to come, even if he has many mitzvot and good deeds. That's pretty tough. So anyway, the truth of the matter is that the Magen Avraham, which is a code of Jewish law interpretation, Rabbi Avraham Gubrina, he explains that according to the Tanya, you're supposed to wear your Yontif clothing. According to other authorities, it's enough to wear Shabbos clothing. But on the intermediate days, between the first and last days of the holiday on Pesach and Sukkot, you're supposed to wear nicer clothing. Absolutely. We had a Hatfield's Farms celebration, this Chol HaMoed Sukkot here in Halifax, and we went there, and obviously you're not going to the farm and you're going to dress in a suit and tie, but I did. Everyone's saying, you don't have to do it here, Rabbi. You're not in town. You're outside of town. You can wear your easy clothing. I said, you're right. If today was Monday or Tuesday, that's what I would do. But it happens to be, today's Chol HaMoed. And this Gemara was in my mind, who disgraces the holidays, has no share to the world to come. So ultimately we see that on special days of the year, and even all year, on Shabbos and Sukkot, we have an obligation to dress in a certain way, in a way appropriate for that day, not to look different, but rather to evoke a certain internal feeling to tell you today's a special day, because externals does influence internals. I don't think you have to judge someone by its cover, but there's no question that when you dress in a suit and tie, you look important, and you feel important. If you dress in a junky pair of shirts and pants, you don't feel important at that moment, even if you're cleaning out your gutter. So that's exactly the code of Jewish law and the point of view of Judaism. And that is, to sum up, there is no obligation to look different in general, according to the overwhelming majority of authorities. We have to be different by keeping the Jewish lifestyle, 613 commandments. However, on certain days of the year, there is obligations on clothing because externals does influence internals.
Excellent.
Okay.
And more to add, besides the fact that it's a custom, the bottom line is that we shouldn't believe that it's a custom. We should have always put the extreme root, so to speak, so
almost,
the face is
almost,
so I should say. Almost. We usually take the extreme root, so Chizum did believe that the Rambam actually mentions it, so I don't know why he's saying it's only faces. The Rambam also mentions that you should actually look different with your...
But the Rambam mentions it, and again, there's a controversy in the Rambam, if that means that you're different from idol worshippers or different from everyone else in the world. The text we have in the Rambam is idol worshippers, not
right.
Everyone.
Right. So Chizum, again, would take the...
That's the way it's quoted in Jewish law, the code of Jewish law, which was not censored.
So Chizum took this more stringent view of saying that we looking different, standing out is, you know, it's part... It's not, I wouldn't say... obligation, and someone that doesn't do it is violating any obligation, but certainly a custom which Chassidim took upon themselves. So, we see it in many different areas where I believe that actually we can see it in Egypt. When the Jews were in Egypt, the Medrash said, although you don't, again, it's not a law, so we don't take the law from before the Torah was given, the Jews were in Egypt, but still it says that the Jews in Egypt didn't assimilate because they kept their separate clothing, separate language, and they kept their Jewish names, so that kept them from assimilating. They were 210 years in bondage in Egypt, so kept them prevented from assimilation, although, again, not a law, but taken that route, that stringent route of standing out, so to speak, prevents you from assimilating. Chassidim definitely took that route, that opinion. So simply a custom of Chassidim have.
And as I said earlier, I think the fraternity issue is very important, and you can't blame them. It does work in most cases. And finally, this is very, very important, we are different in so many ways. The question is, do we have to also look different? Is that something that, as Frank pointed out, dangerous today? Maybe that's one of the reasons why anti-Semites say what they say. Now, anti-Semitism in general, first of all, the term is terrible. Why?
Because Semites include Arabs.
Correct. How many Semitic languages are there? Semitic languages. Eight. So that includes Arabs, so we have to be anti-Jewish, anti-Arab, because Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, it goes on and on. Yemen, Yemenite,
but
so...
The word in terms of its usage
no.
has never connoted being against Arabs or Semites.
Right. Correct. I like the term that I heard from an expert on anti-Semitism, Dr. Gustavo Perednik, and that is Judophobia. Mm-hmm. I think that's a more accurate term. But the question is it just a hate for the Jewish people, a phobia against the Jews? Or did we sometimes do it to ourselves? And I want to mention one thing, and I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, but I want to, in general, I'd say that it's a hatred for the Jewish people, and it's unlawful. There are exceptions. One of the exceptions, I have to admit, is the whole, I would say, culture in Eastern Europe, not in Muslim countries, but in Eastern Europe. There's a very clear distinction between what happened in Eastern Europe and Muslim countries, and that is the Muslims were a little more tolerant of the Jewish people. They kept them in ghettos, but that was it, right? In general, when we speak about an authentic text, we usually don't go back to Europe. Where do we go? To any of the Arab countries where the Jews lived. Why?
There's less censorship.
Less censorship and, more importantly, less anti-Semitism. So there's an authentic text. Nothing was tarnished, and the Jews didn't have to leave overnight. Crusades didn't happen there. Holocaust didn't happen there. It was those countries.
There is an exception.
I was about this. There is a very big exception.
That wasn't by the Muslims.
But again, it was Spanish Catholic Christian. Queen Isabella in 1492 Spain was indeed.
The Muslims took them in. The roads and all.
Absolutely.
Some would say that the Catholic reconquest of Spain, in terms of what it did to the Jews, was a reaction to the very tolerant society that existed there. When the Moors ruled Spain.
Yeah. Absolutely. So anyway, it's very interesting. When you came from Eastern Europe, you didn't have a high regard for the non-Jews around you because of that. And therefore, what is the usually, how do we say in Yiddish or in modern jargon, when you're speaking about non-Jews, if you're from an Eastern European country? Good. Now, first of all, that term, too, is not an accurate term. According to Rav Soloveitchik in the Torah, in Biblical Hebrew, Goy always means one person, the Jewish nation. Yeah. Yisrael, as we say at Mincha, Goy Echad Ba'aret. One nation on earth. What's the one nation? The Jews. What do they call the Jews? The Goy. But it was always a derogatory term. If you're talking about a Gentile and you said Goy, usually it was taken derogatory. And that's very important. When I first came to Halifax, I remember someone said to me, you have a very low regard for the non-Jews. I said, why? You keep on using the word Goy. I didn't understand. Then I understood what they meant, and I stopped using it.
But beyond that,
I stopped because of that. I didn't know that that wasn't my intent, but I understood. But more than that, they called non-Jews terrible names, like Shikts and Shakits. Where did that come from?
From Hebrew.
What's the word Shakits in Hebrew, or Lishakits? Talks about the nations of in Israel, the seven nations, which do idol worship. The Torah says, Shaketz teshaketzenu. It sounds better in Hebrew. Doesn't that sound good? Shaketz teshaketzenu. You should stay away from them. They should be an abomination to you. You should abominate the abomination. Shaketz teshaketzenu. You should get them. So you call the non-Jew a Shaketz and a Shikts because there wasn't a high regard for the non-Jewish society around. And I have to admit that sometimes did evoke certain hatred. Now, I don't feel that's lawful when you want to talk about it ideally. I can't blame people who are living in those places. But ideally, Judaism has a very high regard for people around us. Very high regard. We should devote a luncheon, maybe in the future, to what we've learned from the non-Jewish world throughout history, how it, in some way or another, influenced Judaism. But in general, in my opinion, Judaism could be summed up in one language. Kach et ha'emet mimisham aro. Take the truth from whoever said it, Jew or Gentile. If they said it, it's true, you take it. Poppies is a wonderful custom, and there's no problem for Jews to wear it. It's a beautiful thing, and whoever wrote that poem was not only a genius, he was also a very bright innovative person, and look what an influence he has.